bless us and splash us, for it is time to listen to the most precious podcast on the intertubes. It's our 45th episode of the Femme Fatale. As usual, I will answer your most pressing questions about what really goes on behind the scenes in TV, movies, celebrity, and of course, yada yada. But we also have a very special guest here to help us get through quite a dire time. For those of you who miss True Detective now that it's over, and we no longer have Rust Cole and his sexy nihilism, and all of Reddit conspiracy theories about the King in Yellow, what on earth are mystery and crime TV lovers supposed to do for entertainment? Ditto with any reader of books who is a fan of Malcolm McKay's Glasgow trilogy. If you live in the States, you may recently have finished the ultimate entry in that trilogy. So, what mysteries can we read now? Luckily, we have Nancy Clare. Nancy Clare is here. Say hello.
Hello.
She is the founder. Are you the co-founder?
I am the co-founder.
The co-founder of the forthcoming podcast and blog known as Speaking of Mysteries. Yes. And do we have a launch date for that or not yet?
I'm looking for the Ides of April.
Beware them. Unless you're Nancy Clare, in which case, woo! She's a frequent interviewer of folks like Joe Nesbo, or however you pronounce it. And this week's special guest, her co-host, so hello again. Now, later in the show, she will share her thoughts on what to waste our time on next. Plus, even later in the show, over my years as a Hollywood answer hellion, I have on many occasions been asked about celebrity makeup. Very specifically, I have been asked over and over again whether the pricey stuff that goes on celebrity faces for the Oscars is at all worth the price, or whether we should just go to the drugstore and stay there. I've been doing some research, and I have an early report you're not going to want to miss, especially if the idea of spending $60 for lip balm makes you laugh and laugh and laugh. But before we get to all that, let's get to the VIP interview. Anyone who's addicted to any network TV show may notice an intriguing phenomenon in the end credits. Listener AdamX6000 sure has noticed something. And when he wrote in with the question I'm about to share with you, I knew that only one source would do. Marissa O'Leary is a veteran of the entertainment industry. For years, she served as the head of business affairs for two major TV production companies before trying her hand at talent management. She is our VIP interviewee this week, and let's get to the question. Marissa O'Leary, welcome to the Femme Fatale podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
AdamX6000 asks, from an outside the industry perspective, it would seem like you would want only one or two directors to shoot the episodes for the entire season of a TV show. But when I see the opening credits for a show, they usually have a new director or a director that's not been used in a while for every single episode. Why is that? Because it seems like it would be strange for crew and actors to have a new set boss every episode. So, Marissa, as a former head business boss for a major television production.
Or two or three.
Why is it that whenever we see a new episode of a TV series, there's a new director?
If you're talking about multi-camera sitcoms, you occasionally will see one director do many, 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 many episodes, and there's always an exception that proves the rule. Then, and in the case of single-camera sitcoms, the exception that is currently proving the rule is that Pamela Fryman has directed almost every single episode of How I Met Your Mother.
Yes.
However, you can do that with the sitcom a lot more easily because a multi-camera sitcom is basically rough edited in the camera because they're taking from each camera as they go and making decisions on how it's going to look, and they just come in and punch it up.
So it's easy to have one director doing multiple shows.
It's really easy. When you're doing a 1 hour, which is what I am suspecting your friend here is asking about, there is much more time involved. It takes a director approximately a week of preparation to get the material, to scout the locations, to do the guest star casting, all of these sorts of things. Then approximately a week to 10 days to shoot that, and then approximately another week or so to edit that into a form that is acceptable to the producers and the network. So if one director were to do it all, it would take approximately 3 weeks per episode, and you would end up being painfully far behind on your delivery schedule. You would not have episodes of Scandal available every week for your viewing pleasure. You would have one episode a month, and that would probably not be a big hit.
So when Rising director Ava DuVernay was asked to do a recent episode of Scandal, a single episode of Scandal, that's probably why she was one of several directors for that season.
That's right. They often have a pool of directors and they alternate. And as a show stays on longer and longer, people move up the food chain and get to direct, or you have a show like Scandal where you hired somebody who is already incredibly well known as a director, that being Tony Goldwyn. So you're, of course, going to say, yes, Mr. Goldwyn, would you like to direct an episode? We'd be more than happy to let you, and hope, beyond hope, that it works out to be an episode he was light in anyway, so he's not trying to direct himself in every scene. But sometimes it's deals. You'll see, staying in Shondaland, for example, you see Debbie Allen appearing on Grey's Anatomy and directing on Scandal.
So what's an example of a big-time director that you wouldn't think is a fan of a show? Suddenly a fan of a show and is like, oh my God, yes, come do this show.
You see that more on the pilots. You see big name movie directors doing pilots like Martin Scorsese. But, you know, for the most part, there are certain names in certain parts of directing that are synonymous with success. James Burrows in comedy is pretty much synonymous with success. Barnett Kelman in comedy is another one. Pam Fryman is another one. They're there. But then you get into the one-hour business, and some of the people you wouldn't think of who are directors actually turn out to be really good episodic directors. Tim Matheson directs a lot. Timothy Busfield directs a lot. They did their homework when they were on the set, and they were on a show long enough to get a chance to direct, and it turned out they were really good at it.
So Busfield was on 30-something, and then I think Ken Olin was on 30-something, too, and I think he directs, doesn't he?
Ken Olin is another one. They were all on 30-something. We used to refer to it as the 30-something school of directing, because by the seventh season or so, lots of people got to learn how to direct.
Final question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
True Detective, that show that was so fabulous that's now over.
Yes.
Had a single writer and a single director for the entire run.
And no set delivery schedule. They shot the entire season before they delivered it to the network, which in this case would be HBO. It's also done a lot in the BBC. They shoot everything and then deliver it.
That's Is that before they've even sold it?
No, but before they deliver it. It's ordered, but they shoot a whole season and then deliver it. Alan Ball did that a lot, I understand, on 6 Feet Under. At least the first couple of seasons where they'd shoot the whole season and then it would go on the air. And they can do that in pay cable where they're not as dependent upon immediate ratings. Pay cable is more dependent on what we call prestige television. What makes their money is people signing up for the service just to see that show. If everybody signed up for HBO because they wanted to see, True Detective, then that's better than any ratings they could get. And so they were able to do that, and they were able to have a single writer and a single director.
They really are so powerful that they can say, we'll get it to you when we get it to you?
HBO works that way. They'd rather have it that way, especially when it's more of an auteur's medium. It's been that way in the UK for a long time. It's been like that in a long time. You see a lot fewer notes coming down on British shows than you do here. They deliver a whole group of episodes, and then they air them. They're not as subject to the whims of the audience likes this. For example, going back in ancient history of television, Fonzie on Happy Days was a little guest star wearing a cloth jacket. He wasn't even wearing a leather jacket. And he was only supposed to be there for a little tiny bit, and the audience responded to him, so they were immediately able to increase the size of his role and make him an integral part of the show. If that had been an HBO show, you wouldn't have seen that happen until the next season when they came back. It's why you see on like a show like True Blood, sometimes somebody comes back the next season and they seem to have an awful lot more to do than they did the season before. And I think it's because that show is also primarily shot before it airs. And so they don't respond as much to the audience right away. Nowadays with Twitter, you know by the time a show's finished airing who they like, who they didn't like, what they thought of their clothes, and what they thought of the dog. You know, it's really out there.
Marissa O'Leary, thank you so much for joining me on the Femme Fatale podcast.
Well, thank you, Miss Leslie, and you go out and wreak some havoc.
You too. And now it's time for Nancy Clare. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
Okay. Now, first of all, True Detective is now over.
I know. And it will be missed until it comes back next season with two other characters. That's supposedly the way they're going to do it. Every season, there will be two new detectives.
Do you happen to know if the same director and writer are attached?
Yes.
Oh,
Nick
good.
Pizzolatto, I think is how it's pronounced.
And I hear this rumor that it may be ladies next time.
I haven't heard anything. We'll have to talk to our friends at HBO to see if we can get them to spill the beans.
And we do, supposedly, or at least we thought we had friends at HBO. Maybe they'll throw us a bone and tell us something.
Well, we'll work on it. I'm sure we'll have a pincer action between the two of us. We'll get them to squeal.
We'll use our signature pincer move. But now that Carcosa has been exposed and the King in Yellow has been exposed and we now know what the King in Yellow is, by the way, ew. What are we going to watch on television if we are a mystery or crime fan?
Well, I think you might want to think about The Red Road, which is on Sundance Channel, I believe, and two shows that have already started. The Americans, which is in its second season, absolutely amazing. It is the tensest show on television.
Even now that, you mean now that True Detective is gone or even with True Detective?
Even with True Detective.
Really?
It was up there. I mean, you're tense the entire time. You just really don't know who's going to get killed. And it's all based on truth. You know, you get to relive the 80s. You get to hear that 80s music and high-waisted jeans, which I understand are coming back.
Oh, God. Don't you threaten me. Go ahead.
And Est. And all of these sort of 80s-ish things. But there were Soviet sleeper cells in the United States, and the early 80s was the height of the Cold War. And so knowing that this did go on and seeing it fictionalized is pretty interesting. And oh, by the way, Joe Weisberg, who created it, is a former CIA agent. So he might know whereof he speaks. And the other is Justified. You've just got to love Justified.
Really?
It just holds up. It still holds up. The characters and the writing are pretty brilliant.
I hear it's a little hammy. Is it a little hammy?
Oh, it's a little hammy, but Elmore's always been hammy. You know, think about Get Shorty. I mean, John Travolta and Get Shorty was a little hammy.
But it was fun.
But it was fun, and this is fun. It's very different from The Americans, although both are on FX. And I have my secret vice is The Blacklist.
With the fleshy James Spader.
With the fleshy James Spader and the fleshy bald James Spader. And the woman.
What is it, like the Sex and the City of mystery people?
No, it's not. It's like the ultimate good guy, bad guy. I mean, he's the bad guy that knows everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he's helping an FBI agent for, we don't know what reasons. We don't know if he's her father. We know he was a friend of her adopted father. It's all very nefarious, and it's really good fun. And James Spader can chew up scenery like nobody's business.
As well as Matthew McConaughey in True Detective?
Well, a different level, but Spader's pretty good. I think he does a really good job of being a chubby post-Brat Packer on this.
Is the show well written, or is it silly and you laugh at the silliness and that's what's fun about it?
It's well written enough, and his lines are really brilliant. The unfortunate thing is the woman that was cast opposite him, Megan Fox, I can't remember her last name, not so much.
Eye candy?
No, not even eye candy. She probably just gave a really good what is it when you go and try out for a part?
Reading?
A reading. She probably gave a really, really good reading. And Spader has fun with her too, but he's just so dark and evil. It's really quite good.
Let's go back to Red Road. Why do you recommend it?
Well, I've only seen one episode, but it has that top of the lake-ness without being silly. And for those of
you, good, because Top of the Lake had some problems.
It had problems, but the first episode didn't. The first episode was intriguing.
Yes, it was.
But it went off the top of the lake really fast to the bottom in silliness, I think. I've only seen the one episode. I was impressed. I thought it was good. And I'm going to continue to watch it.
For me, Broadchurch was top of the lake without the problems.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, they canceled it.
What? I thought there was going to be a second season.
I am hearing now that it's been canceled. But maybe
I blame
I'm
David
wrong.
Tennant. I choose to blame David Tennant. Maybe he got difficult.
He looks like he could have gotten difficult. He has that sort of difficult lookingness, doesn't he?
He does.
But you know, the UK has so many of these series that are from their vast number of what they call crime writers that they turn into television that we don't have. Broadchurch, Whitechapel, I thought was very, very good, and I think Whitechapel's coming back. It's the other
not
one.
Not to be confused with Ripper Street.
Maybe it's Ripper Street that's coming back. I think it's Ripper Street that's coming back. But okay. These are all really good British mystery series.
Did you like Endeavor? Speaking of British.
Hated it.
Yeah, okay,
hated
good.
It.
Good, good. Now, for those of you who are not, we're going to talk about this very briefly. For those of you who are not familiar with what Endeavor is.
It is the younger days of
Inspector Morse.
Inspector Morse.
Who looks like Beck and has no real
life.
No. But not in an interesting way.
No, he has no life in a really boring way.
Right.
And you kind of understand why nothing gets done in the police department before he got there, and you're wondering why anything got done afterwards. It's boring.
They try to make it another borderline sociopath detective story, you know, another misfit story. You know, socially awkward guy who is brilliant at solving mysteries, but, you know, can't get a girl kind of a story. But it just feels done. It just feels
played
out.
But The Hour did it so much better with awkward British people who were too thin and had bad haircuts that were actually good haircuts. And they canceled that, which is, I think, unfortunate because that really, I think they did a really good job with The Hour.
So, Red Road, Blacklist, The Americans,
and Justified.
And Justified.
I know you're dancing a little bit casually around Justified, but I think it's fun to watch, and I think they have stayed true to Elmore Leonard's style of writing.
Very good.
And
I also wanted to ask you about Hannibal. I've got a love-hate relationship with Hannibal.
Me too.
And I'm going to talk about this. My friend and fellow podcaster over at The Nerd Out, Lisa B. Jenkins, is obsessed with Hannibal. We watch it regularly. I think it's probably one of the most beautiful shows on television.
Yes.
The writing, I feel, can be problematic because I think there's a lot of stylishly dressed people confronting each other in beautifully turned out rooms and saying things like, you know, you shouldn't have pushed him too far, and then leaving. And I think there's a lot of that. There may be too much of that. And that's my problem with the show. What is your love-hate relationship with the
show? Well, I haven't seen it in the new season. I'm saving it to binge watch. But I agree with you for the end of the last season. It's like, what happened? You know, did he eat that person? Well, no, he didn't because he hasn't become a cannibal yet. But since we are seeing a character we know, we're seeing his backstory. I think maybe we're looking a little too hard for when he turns.
I thought he was already a cannibal.
I don't think he's a cannibal. You see, that's what I mean. Well, maybe it's more enigmatic than I thought.
Maybe it is, but it's very beautiful to look at, and the food styling is just superb.
And he's very good looking.
Oh my
God. In a creepy Bond villain kind of way.
Oh, you're talking about the guy who plays Hannibal.
Right.
I'm talking about the guy who plays Will.
Oh, the guy was, yeah, he's good looking too. There are a lot, like you said, beautiful people, well dressed,
well styled.
But now I have to go back and see whether he is a cannibal yet or not.
Maybe he just eats a lot of things that look like human flesh. And there's a lot of editing cuts that make it look like he's eating somebody that he just killed. And maybe that's the problem.
Well, remember the woman that went to visit him?
Yeah.
And then
the next thing you know, he's like hacking a big piece of meat. That's what I assumed. I assumed
right,
he was eating her.
She shows up.
Yeah.
Later in the episode. So he's not
it was just a lionfish or something. So by the way, I'm also very sad that Malcolm McKay's final book in the Glasgow Treaty is over. It's done. I was addicted to that. I was so addicted to that that I nagged my husband until he read it. And then as he was reading it, I nagged him and asked him which part he was in so that we could discuss whatever had developed without spoilers. So off the top of your head, if you don't have anything, it's fine. But if you have a book that I can read, great.
It's different. But also by a young writer, an American, Roger Hobbs. It's called Ghost Man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a similar kind of character. Writing style is completely different, but it's a similar kind of character. It is up for an Edgar this year. I believe for first-time novel, which he is first-time novelist. He's 27. Graduate of Reed
College.
I'm
already annoyed.
Okay, I know. It really makes you want to hurt yourself.
It does. But go ahead.
But Ghost Man is very, very good. And also it is a mystery from a bad guy's perspective.
Oh.
Not like, unlike Malcolm McKay's.
Oh, all right. So, Ghost Man. All right. Good. That may be my next go-to book because I just have to wait now for Malcolm McKay's standalone story, which is apparently coming in August. And until then, I don't know what to do.
I think you have about enough time to read Ghost Man and then maybe something else. And maybe I'll send you further recommendations.
I would appreciate that. I will post them on my blog at www.thefamefatale.com. I've also been soliciting recommendations in the fantasy arena from my listeners. Don't think I've forgotten about that. I solicited a bunch of recommendations in December. I am going to go through them one by one, and I will be reviewing them as promised. Look forward to that in future episodes. In the meantime, let's move on to our next segment. Thanks to the monthly glossies, we're still hearing about the Oscars, particularly Oscar beauty. For the next few episodes, I'm going to be drilling down on all those expensive brands you saw on actresses' faces on the red carpet, letting you know which ones are worth it and when you're actually better off going to the drugstore. This week, we're discussing A-list lip balms. Thanks to Lupita Nyong'o and her lip balm scene around the world at the Oscars, it is now nigh impossible to get your hands on Clarins, or Clarins if you're an American, lip balm, either online or at a department store. I know this because I tried for you people at three different department stores as well as online because I wanted to review it for you. I had to settle for trying on a sample at a department store. Hated it. It was more like a lip gloss. I can't recommend it. We're not going to review it today because of that reason. I didn't even buy it. It was awful. You should also know Jessica Biel at the Oscars wore a $9 lip balm. $9, not bad. Kiehl's Facial Fuel No Shine Lip Balm. Camila Alves, however, the reality competition host and wife of Matthew McConaughey, used Votrevue's Champagne Kisses Balm on the red carpet that night. It sells for about $22 to $29. So then there's Baume de Rose, a lip balm that sells for, wait for it, $60. And is a favorite of Nigella Lawson and top makeup artist Kate Beckinsale has worn it. Reportedly, Kristen Stewart has worn it. Top fashion publicists won't leave home without it. But are these balms worth it? I asked several makeup artists about this, and the answer is, when it comes to lip balms at least, no. Rachel Herrera, who's a good friend of mine who has worked as a makeup artist for NFL TV, E! She's done Hannah Storm on ESPN, Bachelorette Ali Fedotowsky. She counters that her favorite lip balm ever, Burt's Bees, goes for about $3.30. I also interviewed a makeup artist from Cloutier, which is the go-to beauty agency when stars need someone to make them up for a red carpet event. And the Cloutier makeup artist I spoke to, her go-to, Aqua 4. It's by Eucerin. You can get it at the drugstore for like $5 or less, Walgreens, etc. But I have, just for you and me, Nancy, secured Votrevue's Champagne Kisses Lip Balm and a sample of Baume de Rose. That's right. I spent $60 for the kids. And I want to know your reactions. Now, you've already tried the Baume de Rose. Would you spend $60 for that?
Probably not, but if someone gave it to me, I would use it.
Yeah,
it is really nice.
It is, and you know it's really good when your husband, who's like a guy's guy, you put it on him, and he sits there for a second, and it's on his lips, and he says, "This feels really high end." So you just kind of know that it's really good. I've been using Baume de Rose now for about 4 or 5 days. And I have to say, yes, my lips do look better. It's really addictively soft, pillowy. It adds a nice little pink sheen to your lips. I got nothing bad to say about it except the price.
And $60, you're in foundation territory.
Yeah, it's criminal is what it is. If you've got something that works for you, use it. If you have money and you want to spend it on stuff like this, do that.
It's funny. My go-to is Aquaphor.
Is it?
And so I'm happy to see that
it's the top choice of makeup artists. Now, finally, we do have the Votre Vue. I am going to pop it open. I'm going to try it on. And I'm going to let you know. Hold on. I'm popping it. There it is. Hear that? That's the sound of cardboard popping. Hold on. That's the sound of an expensive thing opening. Here we go. This is coming off. Pop. I'm putting it on. It smells like lemon chiffon pie. It smells like lemon meringue pie. And it's really freaking good. I have to say, this lip balm does go on a lot better than even Baume de Rose. It's a little sleeker, a little slicker. And unlike Baume de Rose, which offers good protection, this actually sinks into my lips instantly and absorbs and softens more instantly than the Baume de Rose. So Camille Alves has good lips, and now so do I. Thoughts?
It is a lot less greasy than the Baume de Rose.
Yes.
And it smells really good.
It makes me want to eat things I shouldn't eat.
Yes.
It does. And it kind of slides pleasantly all over my mouth. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Kiehl's lip balms.
It's less gritty.
It is less gritty
than Kiehl's lip balm.
And it's a little less petroleum-y.
It's not at all petroleum-y, which is really nice, because the Aquaphor is got a tinge of the petroleum.
Petroleum in it. So if you could choose between the Aquaphor and this, would you still go back to the Aquaphor?
No, I think I like this better.
Yeah, I think you do. And it's all yours now.
Thank you.
Thanks to Votre Vue.
I mean, it's a little packed a little like an atomic bomb.
It's an atomic bomb of moisture, Nancy.
Okay.
I don't think we have time for our next question, do we? No, I don't think we do. I've decided that we don't. It's time to wrap up this show. This has been another edition of my show. Here's how you can reach me if you also have a question about what's going on in Hollywood. You can email me at leslie@thefamefatale.com. You can tweet me at Fame Fatale Says. I've also set up a Tumblr. I don't know why. It's called Fame Fatale Says. You can also find me on Facebook. And of course, my website, www.thefamefatale.com. Nancy, what should people look for you?
In the middle of next month, that would be April, please look for speakingofmysteries.com, where our first podcast will be, what do you do with podcasts?
They go live.
Yeah. And then you post them.
That's right.
We will have posted our first podcast. Our first interview is with Robert Kraes, the writer of Suspect. Robert has been named as a Grand Master by the Mystery Writers of America, and he will be feted at this year's Edgar Awards in New York City on May 1st.
Grand Master. Does that mean he wears a robe when you interview him? And like
no,
a wizard
hat? No, he
wouldn't
answer that question, but I did have to address him as Grand Master Bob.
Congratulations. Thank you all so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.